Summer break is here. I want my kids to have fun, but I also want them to keep their skills sharp. Between vacations and sports, I need something that fits our busy schedule without adding stress. That's why we use IXL. IXL is an award-winning online platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts, from pre-K through 12th grade, IXL offers personalized interactive learning that adapts to each child's level and pace. It's proven to improve grades, and one subscription covers every child in the home, saving us time and money. It's trusted nationwide. And in fact, IXL is used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now, and listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLLearning.com/audio. Visit IXLLearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Would you look at that? It's time for some of our favorite Snapple Real Facts. Real Fact 1433, toe wrestling is a competitive sport. Real Fact 732, the chicken is the closest living relative of the Tyrannosaurus Rex. And Real Fact 1599, a man once ate an entire airplane. Youch. Did he have any hot sauce? Yeah, so anyways, this has been a refreshing break brought to you by Snapple. Real tea, real juice.
With Snap's Identity Refreshing!
When equipment breaks down and operations come to a halt, every single second counts. So why is your maintenance team spending 60% of their time doing anything but turning wrenches? Maintain X is the AI-powered maintenance and asset management system that helps your team get back to actually fixing breakdowns. No more searching for manuals. No more hunting down parts. No more drowning in paperwork. With Maintain X, your team can access manuals from anywhere, create new procedures in minutes, and turn voice notes into clear and complete work order feedback. What used to take hours now only takes minutes. Keep your operations moving and your wrenches turning. Join over 13,000 maintenance teams that are already fixing more and filing less. Try MaintainX for free today. Go to MaintainX.com/AI. That's maintain and the letter X.com/AI.
Want a $1,000 weight loss medication for $50? It all starts with Rose free GLP-1 insurance check. Just upload your insurance card to see if you have coverage, then relax. Over 200,000 people have qualified for a $50 copay through Ro. Go to ro.co/health. Half of covered patients have a $50 per month copay or less for medication, plus $145 monthly Ro membership fee. Deductible costs may apply and final cost varies by insurance plan. For safety information about GLP-1 medications, including boxed warning, go to ro.co/safety, Rx only.
In the old days, I would email somebody at the LA Times, somebody at Eater, they would write it up and it would sell out in, you know, in 6 hours. Mm-hmm. Now that doesn't work anymore. A, they don't write about that stuff anymore in the same way because, you know, ever since the Google AI stuff, like when you search, you know, best restaurants in LA, it doesn't send you to an Eater link. It gives you a AI roundup. So the traffic, and this is on all kind of media stuff, went down from thousands and thousands to like 400. So that's led to, you know, layoffs in the media world, and the stuff they cover is different. And so all these things are changing constantly. And so, look, like, I don't want to be the guy sitting around saying, you know, in the old days used to be this. That's like this way lies, you know, irrelevance. So you have to be able to modify and adapt. But it's been, you know, I'm now the guy going on podcasts talking about what the media landscape was like 20 years ago.
Right.
And it's a trip to feel that and really trying to learn and kind of go learn how this stuff goes. And it's been a wild thing to watch changing.
What is up? And welcome to another episode of In a Minute with Evan Lovett, coming to you live from the IAM studios in the heart of Los Angeles. And today we have Noah Galutin, author, cook or chef, do you prefer, by the way?
I mean, I'm not running a restaurant now, so yeah. I'm technically not a chef at the moment,
yeah.
But I am qualified to be one and have been one for many years.
There you go. Formerly of LA Weekly, he's written for The Atlantic, LA Times, does videos on Taste Made, James Beard Award winner, by the way, Substack, Anything involved in food and writing, Noah Galuten does. And right now he has his new book out, Grill Time, which we are celebrating because this is summer and it is grill time right now. So we're going to dive into that. But Noah, welcome to the show and thanks for being here.
Thanks. How's LA Weekly doing these days? They're still going strong?
Do you want to hear something funny? I did a Whatever Happened to LA Weekly episode, right?
Yeah. And I think I know what happened is some weird money came in.
Dude, they got pissed. This is about me. Today's podcast is about me and LA in a minute. No, but they got pissed because I was like, the premise, because at the end I was like, you know, you could still find LA Weekly, but you really got to search hard. It's online-ish.
Yeah.
But I was like, the print, they list all these places you could go get it in print. And I couldn't go get it. I searched and that was part of it. And then they got, they're like, no, we have the, anyway, whatever. So LA Weekly was though, it was very foundational in Los Angeles and very important for
me. I mean, it was massively important for me. I mean, Jonathan Gold was one of the kind of key people who like makes you realize what a cool city you live in. And, I grew up in Santa Monica where your parents find it. They think they found the end of the rainbow. You're raised to believe that nothing good exists east of the 405. Yeah. And then one day your friend comes back from Koreatown and he goes, they bring out all these plates that aren't even the food that you ordered. And I go, excuse me? And then we, you know, end up all going to Sootball Jeep, where I think back then they might not have carded that hard.
Yeah. I had that exact experience at Genoa, I think, was my very first Korean barbecue experience. And like I said, I'm an eater above all, a glutton, some have defined me, described me as. But it was pretty mind-blowing to have that experience.
Yeah.
And I think, listen, this is a good segue. We're going to get into everything in the bigger picture stuff of what you do. But for me, kind of the most unique thing that you did, or uniquely Los Angeles, was when you had, was it during the blog, when you had Man Bites World?
Yeah, yeah.
Man Bites World. It was a blog in the blog era. It was very popular. And you decided to, this is very LA, and this is one of the main reasons he's in here, because this is an LA guy, LA native,
yeah.
Still represent hard. You decided to eat at a different country.
Eat the food of a different country as many days in a row as you can until you run out. And it was born out of like, you know,
Los Angeles. But just to be clear, in LA, which is, again, we always talk about the ethnicity, the diversity, and the, which is true.
Yeah.
But a different country every day. Keep going. Sorry.
Yeah. And so, you know, I was in New York trying to make it as a playwright, came back to LA and, I was just kind of thinking about how I, you know, didn't really know my own city in the way that I wanted to. And that seemed like a fun way to do it. And I wanted to write about it and just kind of have it be this kind of rolling blog diary thing. And that's kind of what kicked off the food writing career. So I did that and it was amazing. And it's like you end up on, you know, like KCRW and stuff like that. But in the way that it's like how somebody made the world's largest rubber band ball or something. Yeah. You're like a novelty act. And then it would go do radio and people would call in and be like, you gotta go to Tashkent Produce for Uzbek food.
Yes,
and
you start here in the Valley, baby. Yeah. Let's go. Valley Village, in fact.
And it was like early, it was like Chow Hound days. And so you're trying to find stuff, you're writing around. I had people invite me to their house to cook, and they go, you won't be able to find this in a restaurant, so come over to my house and I'll cook you dinner. And it was this amazing, eye-opening experience to really explore my own city in a way that I never had before.
I think it's brilliant. And I think it's actually, you know, you compare it to the rubber band ball, which is a novelty. But I think what do you call it? Do you have a name for what you did? I mean, obviously it was on the blog, but like as an accomplishment, because it really kind of is. And it's along the lines of like, you know, we're not comparing anybody to Jonathan Gold. But I think that in this city where people do realize and appreciate the diversity and the richness of culture and food that we have, you're like, no, I'm mapping this out and actually going down this list. Is there anywhere I could find that archive? And do you have a title of it? Because it is really something that's a historical document for Los Angeles.
That's a great question. I assume there's like a broken GoDaddy account somewhere that I don't know how to get back into.
Yeah.
But man, that was a wild time. And I remember, speaking of Jonathan Gold, from that, you know, people were like, oh, he actually could write a little bit too. So I got hired by LA Weekly to start writing for their kind of food blog.
From that?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And I remember Amy Scattergood, who was this amazing editor who hired me there. She told me at one point, she's like, you know, Jonathan is like a little like territorial competitive that you're here. And I remember thinking, oh my God, Jonathan Gold knows who I am.
That is the dream. I will tell you, Jonathan Gold, I was amazed. And this is one of the reasons. To this day, I respond to every DM or email that I get. DMs on Instagram only, by the way. But if somebody takes the time to personally write to you, I feel it's important. Because one day I wrote an email to Jonathan Gold, and he wrote back, and I was like, wow. Like, he took, and he like added, he wasn't just like, oh, hey, thanks. He's like, check out this restaurant. Like, you said you live in the Valley. Like, have you been? I was like, wow, Jonathan Gold. Like, and it's not the same as, you know, recognizing.
No. But it's amazing.
I was touched, and yeah. I feel like that's like an important connection. But again, let's just talk about this for a second.
Sure.
What, you grew up on the West Side, mm-hmm. which is very insulated. And I went to UCLA. You went to UCLA.
I did.
Probably similar time. Just, you know, I don't want to
based
judge
on how anybody. We look.
Yeah, I'm saying roughly around. But you're totally right. And still a lot to this day, less than before. But if you're on the West Side, you're on the West Side. If you're in the Valley, you're in the Valley. If you're in the East Side, even if it's the fake East Side, the East Siders call the East Side, you're in the East. And there are all these little, not even enclaves, but basically insulated areas that of self-isolation that people would remain in.
Yeah.
Was that a main factor for you on delving out and just doing the country project?
Absolutely.
I want a name for this. By the way, by the end of the show, we're going to have a name for this.
Yeah,
this project you did. And I want an archive. I want you to go back and find that GoDaddy and republish it. No,
just, but yeah, it's almost like, you know, what's the term for tourism of your own hometown? It's like something like that. It's loco tourism or something.
There you go.
And yeah, it was just this kind of realization. And, you know, you're reading Jonathan Gold and he's telling you about the amazing places. You're watching, you know, Anthony Bourdain and reading his stuff. And I'm sitting there going like, this guy's traveling all around the world, eating all this amazing stuff. And I'm just sitting at home and I'm not experiencing that. I want to like really become a member of my own city in a way that I wasn't before.
Awesome.
And that was kind of the premise. And I just, you know, also you're, you know, like, the recession was kicking in at that time when you're trying to find something to do so you don't go crazy. And I think I was still getting unemployment from like from my previous job. And I was just kind of like trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And it was also an excuse just to write every day, to have experiences every day, to meet people. And you start to discover all these things that are incredible. And you go to, you know, Garden Grove and Torrance and San Gabriel Valley and you start to like find these amazing pockets. And I remember Jonathan Gold always said that his goal with his writing was to make people less afraid of their neighbors. And I think there's that element to it as well. And it also that kind of that mentality is what led to my whole career. I mean, you know, my career with, you know, Kevin Bledsoe has become a very dear friend and mentor.
Trust me, we're getting into Bledsoe.
But yeah. So there's a lot of stuff. And so that's, you know, like, I mean, even still, people, when you tell them that you, you know, went to Compton, they're like, was it safe? You know,
that was me on Watts Towers when I first did. And go on.
That's what I'm saying. So that's all part of it. And, you know, I always think that, you know, fear comes from lack of understanding.
The unknown.
And so, you know, if you're nervous about it, you know, anything in your life, preparation and experience is the thing that fixes it. And so go out there and explore it.
So you brought up something so important that I always focus on with Elliot a Minute and my adventures is discovering these neighborhoods. You know, you've heard of, you know, obviously we're aware, whether it was Gardena, Wilmington, you know, Boyle Heights initially, where you're like, you know, I've been there, been through there, seen the site. But then you get off and you go explore, and every community, especially in LA, is a community, and they're all like these magical, wonderful places. And at the core of them is the food and these little restaurants, these mom and pops and the cliche strip malls in Los Angeles, but that really is, or the stands or the vendors and all this stuff. And just to, you know, keep focused on this a little bit more, you're talking about, you went to Afghani places. You had a Kenyan meal, home cooked, or Kenyan and Senegalese, I think, were together.
Yeah. There was an amazing Ghanaian place that I found that was like, no one had heard of. And it was like, and that place was incredible. It's no longer here, sadly, but it was like a market with people cooking in the back, and you come in. And I just remember with a lot of these places, you come in and you're like, you know, the only white guy who's walked in there in a long time. And they go like, you know, this is, I remember she said to me, she goes, you know, this is African food. And I go from Ghana. Right. And she goes, how do you know that? She goes, you like spicy? And I go, I love spicy. She goes, well, sit down. And so that was like you like spicy is often like the, okay, you can hang. And it was amazing. I still think about that meal. It was like an okra stew with like, I think it was like kenke or fufu and like fried fish. And it was just this amazing thing that, you know, you will never find that on, you know, Uber Eats. Are they a sponsor, by the way?
This is no, Uber Eats is not a sponsor. But I will say one of the important things about this for me, for what you did. And I see this with Counterintelligence, Jonathan Gold's like amazing book. It's not the reviews. It's not the meal, even though it is memorable and that's an important part of it. But you're giving a snapshot of a time and place, that place, Los Angeles. But again, the representation of all the cultures and all the countries. And, you know, the World Cup's going on right now. I did an episode on which are the five nations in the World Cup that have the lowest population in Los Angeles, by the way, which I found very, very interesting.
Yeah.
But the point was, they're all here. Every country on the globe is represented here, and it makes Los Angeles like a very special place. And the way to present that is through the food.
Yeah.
And everybody has the different, you know, representation culinarily. And that's, you know, speaking to the rest of Los Angeles, to the rest of the world through the food. And we all know that food is what bonds people, you know, and things like
yeah.
that. And that's why I think what you did, rubber band ball novelty aside, was really an important archival snapshot of Los Angeles and something that really represented the city extremely well. And kind of what makes you a special person with a really good approach. And I'm glad that that was a springboard to your career. Tell us about that. Like going to LA Weekly, now all of a sudden you're a bona fide food writer.
Yeah.
Did you think that your career would take that turn? How did that sort of develop?
I mean, I never knew what it was going to be. I was always just kind of like a go toward excitement person. Yeah. And I always, you know, I was a writer first and foremost as a kid. It's always what I loved doing.
And theater arts major at UCLA, right?
Yeah. I studied playwriting at UCLA and studied literature at UCSB. And I was just a very like, you know, focused on these kind of things. And, you know, this, I always say we're like a generation of failures because my generation, especially like, you know, like white liberal Santa Monica was very much a, you know, you're raised to believe you can be anything you want. And so you have this incredible confidence in your art form and the things you want to do. And then you turn 21 and realize you didn't become Ernest Hemingway. And now you've already failed to achieve the thing you thought you'd do, like right out of college and be the star. And then you kind of have to go, okay, like we now have failed at the initial dream. And now what? And you've got your whole life ahead of you. And so you start to find your way through it. And I was always somebody who pushed back on settling into the job that, you know, if you'd stayed there, you could have kept growing and building and going. And I'm me saying, no, I see the future and it scares me. I don't want that future. I'm out. I'm going to go try something else. And so, yeah, the food writing, you know, was this way in. And then of course, you know, waiting tables and bartending and, you know, it was kind of the early days of kind of the glorification of being a like a restaurant misfit of the, what, you know, Bourdain always described as like the pirate ship. And it's obviously changed and become a very different thing now.
Yeah.
And so I kind of was like, as a guy who spent, you know, his whole life sitting at a desk trying to write more than everybody else, it felt good to be on my feet, you know, washing dishes in the back of a restaurant and pulling pints at a bar and then like going and writing about real things and real people. And so that was kind of the springboard for that part of my life.
Tell me about that era, because I always call that like, and it's a misnomer, I still always call it that, but I call it the LA food renaissance, right? Like probably about 2008 to 2019, like right before, where Los Angeles always had great cuisine and great restaurants, and all, but we were always pushed to the side where you're not New York, you're not San Francisco, you don't have the white tablecloth Michelin restaurants, all that kind of stuff. But people started discovering what had already existed in LA, and obviously, you know, TV and the Chopped and coming off of Iron Chef and Iron Chef America, which by the way, Iron Chef Japan, one of my favorite shows.
Yeah.
That show,
him saying honey while holding two giant like honeycomb things, is still my favorite moment in television.
Branzino was mine, and I still rep the Branzino, because now Branzino's on everybody's menu, right? Now that literally you can't go to a restaurant that doesn't have Branzino on it. But I remember like the close-up of the fish, and they do that thing with the camera where they're like getting out, they're like, Branzino!
Yeah.
Like, so to this day, whenever I see it, I text my buddy Tim with a Anyway.
The chairman.
But yes. And I got to intervene to give a word out for LA Rise's Rebuild Hub. It's been more than a year after the fires. A lot of people are back home, but more people are just starting to rebuild or in the middle of their rebuild. If you're one of those people rebuilding, go to Rebuild Hub. It's larises.org/rebuild. It's resources, vendors, contractors, builders, and it's a good resource to explore options, to compare, and it's free for you to go to the site and check out the resources. They put it together. LA Rises did a really, really good job, and it's the Rebuild Hub. larises.org/rebuild. Check it out. What was it like? You're coming up and you were kind of defining and writing the culture during that era where finally, you know, Bon Appetit or Food and Wine, we're recognizing LA as an exciting food city finally. But it really was an exciting food city was the thing. So what was it like during that era for you?
I mean, to a certain degree, I was kind of discovering it at the same time and realizing how great I had it. And, you know, for so long, and part of it is also like the media gatekeeping of it all too, of like, you're judged by the quality of your French and Italian restaurants. And like, that's kind of it. And, you know, when people finally realized that, you know, the food that had been existing here and was great all this time is important. And then you get to start, you know, evolving it and having, you know, like, you know, higher end versions of these cuisines, and people are willing to kind of branch out and find those things. So it was a cool time, but like, I think of the early days of like, those like Chowhound people, of like people on message boards finding restaurants. I mean, and that's kind of the early sense of that community. You know, I mean, I still remember being a PA and having a Thomas guide in the back of my car driving around being like, okay, you got to scroll to the B4, you find this. And eventually you're just like, I think if I drive south, I'll hit the 10 and I can find my way home. And so it's like stuff for sure. And so, you know, that sense of, you know, it's much harder, it feels like, to discover something now.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, that's the way media has changed. We think about like sports too. It's like people killing each other, you know, not literally, to break the news about something that they're going to be announcing in a press release 3 hours later,
like
a coaching hire or who's MVP getting drafted.
Shams leaked the MVP for the NBA a few weeks ago. And people were like pissed off because the official net. And it was like, yeah, it's a go.
Yeah. And they're trying to get the news out there, and you're just trying to get it out faster than anybody else. Right. And so it's like, that kind of part of it is wild to think about. And so every once in a while, when somebody really discovers something, it's cool. But then there's stuff too, like old restaurants, like, and all of a sudden someone would be like, you know, like, yeah, did you hear that like Barney's Beanery blew up on TikTok? Dude. And I'm like, what is happening? That used to be where I would get a drink with friends on a Saturday night so I could actually just talk to my friends and have a beer on a Saturday night, because it was the only place that wasn't slammed. And now it's like, I guess it was like a TikTok thing for a while.
You like Asanebo, you know, the sushi restaurant Asanebo.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
So I remember when the initial Michelin guy finally came to LA. And this is when my wife and I were like, we wanted to like go to the Michelin place and all that kind of stuff.
You always need to know where French tire salesmen want to eat. And that's how you really find your way around Los Angeles.
Right? That's the origin of the Michelin guy. But seriously, Asanebo, which was in the Valley, is in the Valley.
Yeah.
Was, I don't want to say it was the only sushi restaurant, but it was one of the only Japanese restaurants on the list. And we're like, oh, we've never been there. And we go and it's great and blah, blah, blah. But what's funny is it somewhere along the line became kind of sort of old and less exciting and new than maybe it was. And it had been established for a while, but less exciting. But now all of a sudden it's had this big renaissance.
Oh, funny.
Because the chef there is a big TikTok personality.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So much personality and all these guys. So it's kind of interesting. Let's talk about that for a little bit. Just the changing landscape and how restaurants embrace social media or not.
Yeah.
And what that means and how that determines a restaurant's fate almost, I mean, at this point, which is kind of dangerous.
The whole media landscape is so different now. I mean, I'm promoting my book now, and versus my last book, whatever it was, 3 years ago, it's already so different.
The Don't Panic Pantry Cookbook.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so like, you know, I've got all these events we're throwing. We threw this amazing asada here in LA to kick off the cookbook tour. And I had my friend, Chef Eloy Aluri from Hermosillo. He flew up to do this very specific Hermosillo style asada we highlighted in the book.
I was watching your video where you showed that the asada down there was different than like what we know as the marinated. Like
it was incredible. Changed my entire view of a carne asada.
Yeah.
But trying to promote that event. In the old days, I would email somebody at the LA Times, somebody at Eater. They would write it up and it would sell out in, you know, in 6 hours. Mm-hmm. Now that doesn't work anymore. A, they don't write about that stuff anymore in the same way. Because, you know, ever since the Google AI stuff, like when you search, you know, best restaurants in LA, it doesn't send you to an Eater link. It gives you a AI roundup. So the traffic, and this is on all kind of media stuff, went down from thousands and thousands to like 400. So that's led to, you know, layoffs in the media world, and the stuff they cover is different. And so all these things are changing constantly. And so, look, like, I don't want to be the guy sitting around saying, you know, in the old days used to be this, that's like this way lies, you know, irrelevance. So you have to be able to modify and adapt. But it's been, you know, I'm now the guy going on podcasts talking about what the media landscape was like 20 years ago.
Right.
And it's a trip to feel that and really trying to learn and kind of go learn how this stuff goes. And it's been a wild thing to watch changing, but that's how it always goes.
And you've seen it from all sides, which is interesting. And again, we're going to get into the blood, so because I think that's really important. But I do want to talk about, you said now you need to do on essentially press junkets. Like you were just on Today Show.
Yeah.
You're doing a book tour, New York, now back to LA. And then you see you're going back to New York again.
I did those already. I go next up. I don't know if this comes out imminently or not, but I'll be. So, go to noahgluten.com to find the tour dates. I'm doing a 21 city tour.
That's cool.
So next up, I go to Nashville and then Charleston, then do a whole big California run, and then Pacific Northwest, and then Texas and all this stuff. But that, to be honest, like as a guy who's not day to day in restaurants anymore, I was just excited to get back out there and be in restaurants again. And also I've made friends with some of the best chefs in the world and they're here in America. And so like, I'm doing a pop-up at a Michelin-starred, not to credit Michelin again, a Michelin-starred tapas restaurant in Charleston with these amazing people. And I get to like cook with Renee Erickson in Seattle. And I get to, you know, cook with Aaron Franklin in Austin, Texas.
Yeah, I saw Franklin did a, what do they call it, a blurb on this book.
Yeah,
I was pretty impressed, actually.
Yeah. I mean, when you get Aaron Franklin and, you know, Kenji Lopez, you get some good blurbs. But so it's like that part of it is so exciting just to like, for me to get back out and do stuff again, like, you know, you can go do a signing at a bookstore and that's fine, but it's a grilling book. Let's go out and have some fun in the cities and go meet people. And like, I had a blast. I was in St. Louis and Buffalo and it was amazing. I'm going to do another pop-up here in LA in August with Bub and Grandma's, do a little sandwich pop-up. And we'll be down in Redondo Beach, with this guy who has Ichimiyan, this incredible handmade soba place down in Torrance. Wow. We're doing a pop-up at a select beer store, which is Redondo or Newport, I forget now. We're doing like grilled soba bowls and really fun beers and stuff. Like you find people that you know. In fact, I think that one came out from doing somebody else's podcast, and I shouted out the soba place Ichimiyan that I love it. Yeah. And then he reached out and he's like, we should do something.
That's superb. So again, the networking, the interconnection of everything.
It's the only good part about Instagram is DMing. How you can like, I have relationships, books I've written people that you met through, like, you know, you go to the restaurant, you tag them, they write back, you become friends and you hang out and, you know, it's how you met your mistress, right? You said you respond to all DMs.
Wow. Holy moly. I thought we were keeping that under wraps, man. No. So let's get into the grilling. This is why we're here. This, again, summer kickoff. First, give us a breakdown of grill time.
Yeah.
Okay. So this tell us what this is about. Grill time. This is, look at this. No, grill time, new book.
This
no
is balloon. Yeah. The way that I grill for my friends and my family. This is, as a dad of a 2 and a 4-year-old, I actually grill more now than I did before. And part of it is that, you know, it's not just, you know, having fun on a weekend and throwing some steaks and burgers, throwing a party. It's also I find to be the easier way to get food on the table sometimes. And like being able to also with like kids and dietary restrictions and their friends come over and the other parents and they don't eat shellfish, they don't eat this. If you were trying to cook like chicken, steak, shrimp and vegetables on the stove,
yeah,
you would have an aneurysm. You'd have oil splatter over, it'd be a giant mess.
Thanks.
But on the grill,
over, bro. Yeah.
On the grill, just brush and done and your kitchen is clean. And so this is, you know, I've gotten to learn, I dare you to find somebody with a more impressive and diverse mentor list than I have. And so like I've gotten to learn vegetables from Jeremy Fox.
Yeah, you know, that I saw. Huge name.
You know, Kevin Bludsoe on barbecue and yeah, from Compton. Ari Colander with seafood, who's got all the amazing restaurants here in L.A. Queen's Raw Bar and Grill and Found Oyster. And so I've gotten to learn from all these incredible people. And then you filter it through your own brain, the way you think about food. And this book is 40% vegetarian, not as like some stance I have, but just as the way that I cook for my family. Like part of being a good father is keeping your kids and your family alive.
Right.
And so you can't just feed them like steak and buffalo wings.
Yeah.
You got to like get that fiber in there. You got to get vegetables. You got to teach balanced diet. And then on the weekends, you get to do the really fun weekend project grill. You can take a wood and charcoal grill and cook a 2-inch thick ribeye, reverse seared on the smoke side, then finish on the grill, throw a compound butter on top, and you get this beautiful, smoky, medium rare, perfect piece of meat. Or like grilled ribs, or I'll even smoke a turkey breast on a grill with wood and charcoal and then chill it down and slice it. And I've got the best turkey cold cuts for my kids' lunches. And so that's the way that I think about it. It's an extension of your kitchen. You know, you can also throw stuff on and char it, fold it into some beans or some rice. I do like a kebab plate rice in this book. Yeah. That's inspired by every single Lebanese, you know, takeout meal I've had, you know, for the last 30 years of my life. And the way I kind of mash up the tomato and the grilled Anaheim and all this stuff and just fold it into your rice and have it with some shish tawuk. It's like, this is a city that teaches you that there's so many incredible ingredients and markets and everything's so easy to access now with online ordering of ingredients that all these jars and canisters and cans and meats, they all start to kind of spill into each other. And all of a sudden you start just making what I think is Los Angeles cuisine.
Beautiful, beautiful testimony about the book. How did you get into, where was your origin of grilling? Where did this even start? Where did this begin?
Yeah.
Where are the seeds of this?
I mean, look, you grow up, you grill here and there, but you know, again, growing up in Santa Monica, you're raised to believe that barbecued chicken is a boneless, skinless chicken breath grilled with some KC masterpiece. And then this, not to lead the witness, but
hey, sweet baby Ray's sometimes.
Sure.
Go on. Yeah.
It gets the job done, but it's not barbecue in the same way. And so, a big turning point for me was I went to Bludsoe's Barbecue in Compton for the first time.
Let's get into it. Yeah.
And so you did your catchphrase.
Was that part of your writing or was that as a fan or was that out of curiosity?
First as a fan, just went to go check it out.
Absolute barbecue royalty. Shout out Kevin Bludsoe. Yeah.
And I had his collard greens and brisket.
Yeah.
And I was just like, this is just, again, changes everything you think you know about what barbecue is. And so I went down there, ate the food, and then I immediately emailed my editor, Amy Skettergan, and go, can I interview Kevin Bludsoe for LA Weekly?
Yeah.
And she was like, please, like, we would love to have, you know, again, it's that, you know, Eurocentric view a lot of times on, you know, the food landscape back in the day.
Yep.
So I interviewed him for LA Weekly, ended up turning into a 2-part series. I'd been talking to my buddy, James Starr, former Crossroads backup point guard to Baron Davis.
Right.
Shout out to Big Game James.
Yes.
And he owned the Golden State, which was where I was waiting tables and you know, slinging beers back in the day.
Okay.
The famous beer floats from the early days of Fairfax, back before it changed completely. And so I was like, how cool would it be if you could eat that food and drink a beer and watch a game in LA proper, not just all the way down in Compton, where it's more of a takeout stand than an amazing place. And so I interviewed Kev and he started talking about, I'm looking for some young people to, you know, help me grow this business.
Yeah.
And I remember going back and playing that recording before I transcribed it for my friend James. He was like, holy crap, we got to do it. So we went back down to Compton, talked to Kevin, and he goes, listen, a lot of people are trying to work with me. So, you know, you guys seem nice, yada, yada, yada. He didn't say yada, yada, yada.
Right.
He goes, but tell you what, I'm going to my granny's 90th birthday party in Corsicana, Texas. Y'all should roll. So kind of joking, but James and I bought tickets.
A big invite, yeah.
We show up at the Martin Luther King Community Center in Corsicana, yeah. Texas. Okay. Three white dudes roll up. Kev says the record scratched when he walked in. And then Kev says, these people are real important to me. And everyone goes, all right. Cut to, it's 3 a.m. I'm drinking corn rye and singing Sam Cooke songs with old ladies. And we kind of sealed the deal to work together. So Kev, I was going to be the general manager because I, you know, I'm not a chef back then. I was just, you know, a guy who loved food and cooked a lot and, you know, had worked in a lot of restaurants. And so, but I wanted to learn the business. So I started going to Compton at 4 o'clock in the morning. And Kev didn't tell anybody who I was or what I was
doing.
Where
were you living at this time, by the way?
I think at that point, I think I'd just broken up with my girlfriend. I was back at my parents' house in Santa Monica. And so Kev didn't tell anybody I was coming. He said, I want to see how he reacts, see what he does.
Okay.
So I showed up. Back then, Felix, who was the pit guy back then, had a gun in his back pocket. And he goes, okay, come on in. They throw me in the back. I'm peeling potatoes, cleaning collard greens. I'm thinking, I can't believe I'm working at Bloodsoe's Barbecue right now.
Yeah.
And I kept kind of doing it 4 a.m. Going in the mornings. And I would go to my other job, you know, at 10 when I'd finish in Compton. And eventually they start letting me, you know, season the rib tips, put them on the smoker, tend the fire. And by the time we found a space, which is the one on La Brea, Kevin said, you're the only person I trust with my food because you actually came and worked here. You're the chef. And so I became the chef of a, you know, 120 seat barbecue restaurant and bar that, you know, I remember
such
like
an important legacy though. It's not just like a random new restaurant, which in itself is important.
Of course.
But this is Bloodsoe's. This is royalty. This is carrying forward probably the most important barbecue flag in Los Angeles, and one of the most in the United States. But
it's
a lot of responsibility,
of
man.
Of course, and I remember thinking like, this guy's name is on the building. I can't mess this up, and it's tough too because like, you know, I always say that, you know, context affects flavor. You know, barbecue eaten on a you know, fine china, you know, at a nice restaurant doesn't taste as good as out of a styrofoam box on the side of the road, and so we are now changing the context of it. And so, like, it has to be, you know, better than Compton to taste the same, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And you're sort of battling against expectations and context and, you know, the prices are different, but there's TVs and a bar. And it took off and it went really well. And from there, I got to, they opened Koufax Coffee and I did the menu for that. And that kind of blew up. The smoked potato breakfast burritos became a thing from that. And then I got to help open Prime Pizza, which is now there's 7 trillion locations.
It's a phenomenon. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's where I learned pizza from the great Frank Pinello in New York. And I got to help with that. And so it's just become this kind of bizarre thing. And so then when I go back to now cooking for my family and grilling and all this stuff, it's like I take so much I learned from Kevin and we wrote a cookbook together that won a James Beard Award.
That's
and,
right.
And so
that's
I got right. to learn from Kevin and all these people and it becomes, you know, your own way of thinking about food, you know, evolves, but you still are the core of who you are, but you get educated from all these people and it just elevates everything that you're doing. So this is a 20 plus year career of cooking and writing and learning from incredible people, filtered through the way that I think about food and the world.
Man, brilliant, brilliant way to circle back on that too. And so tell me about right now your relationship with Kevin.
I mean, he's one of my favorite people in the world. And we actually, I always say, if you want to see your friends, you got to work together. So there's a channel called Taste Made, which is one of those channels that I always say, if you have it, even if you don't know you have it, it's on everything. It's on, you know, Vizio, it's on, you know, Roku, it's on DirecTV. You can go to their app directly. And they reached out to me because I'd worked with them on some stuff in the past. And they said, how'd you feel about doing an outdoor cooking show? And I said, yeah, that'd be amazing. And I was like, but if we want it to be a hit, we should shoot it in Corsicana, Texas with me and Kevin Bloodsoe. And there we're doing it. And it's we shot 5 episodes. They took off like crazy. It's me and Kev cooking in the backyard.
Yeah.
And then they just picked us up for 25 more. So we're making a whole bunch more. Awesome. And I get to fly into Texas and hang with Kevin. And we get to cook together in the backyard. And we're smoking and grilling and making breakfast and shooting the crap. And he's amazing. And so he's an absolute legend. And obviously he had like a Netflix show and all those things too. And we just get to hang out with your friend. Bloodsoe's now is probably open almost 15 years at this point.
Yeah.
The one we opened on La Brea.
Right.
And, we got to open a blood sows in a casino in Australia at one point. That was a whole crazy thing. Yeah. They eventually closed because they lost their gambling license because they were, I think, illegally coercing Chinese businessmen to come to Australia. Well, they ended up in a Chinese prison, so I would think so.
Okay.
Fair. At least it's illegal in China. But anyway, yeah, so it's been this kind of wild, amazing ride. I mean, just like thinking about the amount of time I've spent with Kev, like I was with him, you know, writing the book when like I've gotten amazing news and bad news. And, and you know, we've just, it's a career that, and a friendship that goes back really far. And now we get to hang out, we get to shoot more, we get to pop down to Texas, bring a whole crew, and get to bring all these other people who I love down to Texas, right. And we get to work together and cook together. And it's, I never would have expected how much of my life was as like a hyper, like liberal, I would say I'm like a George Carlin Democrat.
Yeah.
Who grew up in Santa Monica, the amount of time I spend in Texas now, my wife's from Dallas, so in-laws are down there shooting with Kevin all the time. So Texas has become probably the place. And then going back full circle, when I first did a consulting thing for Walmart back in the day down there, that like it wasn't until I was gone from LA and in Texas that I realized how much Korean food is like a core kind of comfort food for me. And there's a huge growing population down in Texas. I'd go to like Carrollton and I'd be like, man, this has been a long day. I gotta go like get some sun tofu and get some like kimbap for the road and stuff like that. And so like it became this, I didn't realize how much of a deep comfort food it was until I left LA.
And again, food bringing everybody together, George Carlin versus George Bush, if you will. But there you are, where food is the great uniter. I want to talk about barbecue in Los Angeles. Yeah. That's something that's always kind of bothered me a little bit is we don't really have an entrenched great scene of all the great cuisines we have. And there are good spots, obviously, yeah. You know, Moose Craft, Blood Sows. I'm an old school fan of Hoggly Woggly, yeah. Tyler Texas and Van Nuys. That's where I grew up with eating their big beef ribs.
Oh, fun.
On my birthday, my dad's birthday, we'd always go there. But there's not a lot of places, and great ones tend to not survive that long. There's one Smoke City in Van Nuys that closed down after 4 or 5 years. Why does LA not have a great barbecue scene?
I mean, first of all, I mean, barbecue is expensive. Yeah. It's expensive to make it. It's expensive to do it in that way. But there's a lot of, you know, Kevin always talked about this. There's a lot of LA history of barbecue. And he said he always, you know, loved it growing up because everybody came to LA. So LA had every style of barbecue. Yeah. And so he would mention places that were before my time, like Gadberry's, okay. And like Woody's is still around, right? Woody's still around, right?
Not sure.
And so there is this long history, especially where all the barbecue was happening was in the areas that weren't written about. So, you know, like south of the 10 is where a lot of this barbecue was happening back in the day. And so that was a big part of it. And so, barbecue's hard. It's, you know, I'll throw you some barbecue math, but like you buy a 15 pound raw brisket.
Yeah.
It became a very expensive cut because, you know, once again, like white people discover it and now it's expensive. Oxtails now too, you know? Yeah. And so now you cover it in salt and black pepper. Black pepper, one of the most expensive spices when you're doing it at scale like that. Then you put it not on a fire, but near one for about 14 hours with wood and charcoal. You're smoking it. You finish cooking that 15 pound brisket. Now it's 10 pounds. Okay. So you've just all that fat is just down the drain. You're charging you for that fat that's rendering out of it. You trim some of it off at the end. You end up serving about 8 pounds of that 15 pound brisket with labor, wood, smoke, all that stuff. And so like, and then people think barbecue is supposed to be cheap. And so, you know, it's like with Chinese food, Mexican food, that people like, they have certain expectations of what a cost is supposed to be.
Right.
Even though like at the end of the day, but like, you know, give me a Neapolitan pizza that's 70% water, 2 ounces of cheese, and it's basically a bread bowl of tomato soup, and you just charged $26 to somebody, and they're like, no problem. Feeds one, and I'm paying for 2 ounces of cheese, 3 ounces of tomatoes, and like a little bit of flour and water. But, you know, you get a rack of ribs, and that's supposed to be cheap? Like, give me a break.
That's a good economic breakdown right there. But and you know, so the cost, the time, the resources, but it's still, I mean, a lot of cuisines have expense. Do you think LA's appetite for barbecue is
I mean, based on Bledsoe's, it does really well. Yeah. So I think when you do a good job with it, when you run the business in the right way and you have, you know, people that can handle that, it's, I mean, barbecue is also a thing I think a lot of people get into because they're good at making barbecue. They open a place and they make it.
Yeah.
And then you don't necessarily have, you know, the training on all the restaurant side of stuff. And that's where I think, you know, what happens all the time with the restaurant business in LA and everywhere is like, being able to, you hear it all the time. Everyone tells me I'm the best cook in the family. I got to open my own restaurant. But that's so different from knowing how to run a business. And restaurant business is so different from other businesses. Like if you're trying to get rich, there's a lot of better ways to do it.
Oh, yeah.
And so that side of it, I know so many brilliant, amazing, talented chefs who, you know, made the wrong deal with the wrong person, didn't know how to crunch the numbers on the lease. And like, you're basically... you're done before you open. And so that happens a lot too. And so, I think it's, you know, it's the barbecue business is hard. I mean, I always remember when I was getting ready to be the chef at Bledsoe's, I was like, all right, Kevin, ready for those 100-hour weeks. And he said, 100-hour weeks, what are you working part-time? Oh, and he was right. I mean, it was the first few months was 20 hours a day, 7 days a week.
But you love it and your heart's into it.
Yeah. I mean, I lost my mind a few times and had a few panic attacks and Kev had to come in and help me out and, you know, make sure I was being taken care of and all this stuff too. And part of it was also I was not qualified to be a chef.
Right.
So I was making tons of mistakes. But like,
and you're learning.
If you're trying to be there, when you open a restaurant, you want to be there for every stage of it to make sure everyone's doing their job right. And when the brisket's 14 hours and you take that off, now you're putting the ribs and chickens on, you're also doing the sides, you're open for dinner and you're smoking all night. Like that's, I would like, you know, it's like you take a nap on the couch.
Well, you talk about business being hard and you talk about, you know, running a business and there's different elements that make it difficult. That's why the DCBA exists. They're a new partner, new sponsor. It's the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs. They're celebrating their 50th anniversary this year, started by the legendary Ed Edelman in 1976 to protect consumers from fraud, from different grifts, different scams, unfair business practices. And it's a county organization that's really taken on a role to help recover money for consumers. Recently, after the wildfires, they were very active in limiting price gouging. And this is something, it's a public resource that you can reach out to. It's a safety net for people. Again, when you think there's predatory practices from businesses and just have consumer protection, or if you are a business and you're not getting the answers you need from the county, from the city, you can always go to the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs. So they're celebrating their 50th anniversary of protecting consumers and businesses, right here in Los Angeles. And they're an organization that, you know, people, I didn't know about them. I've had an Elliot Minute episode about them, learned all the good things that they do for consumers. So Department of Consumer Business Affairs, 50-year anniversary. Appreciate them. And they're doing a lot for the county of Los Angeles.
Hey, LA's been collecting out-of-town scammers for centuries. So you need somebody out there to look out for them.
Man. There you go. But let's talk more on a broad scale. And in the business note, Los Angeles is going through a rough time, you know, business and otherwise. Yeah. What do you see as far as the restaurant landscape and the changes in evolution in what's going on with businesses? And I'll tell you something that I tend to hear, obviously, is we're hanging on by a string. And obviously, you know, it's never been a great industry to make money, like you said.
For sure.
But now with the costs and with lawsuits, ex-employees and all this kind of stuff, rent, all the different challenges we're seeing in LA. What do you see as far as your perspective on the landscape?
I mean, it's constantly changing. The landlord situation sometimes can be really tough. You see people sitting on expensive real estate that would rather sit on the empty spaces and keep their prices high and wait until somebody comes around rather than try to be a real partner and try to make something great. And I'm a George Carlin Democrat. So one of the things I think about a lot is how, you know, the venture capital version of America is like ruining it, in my opinion.
Goddamn.
And so look at the restaurant landscape, you know, you go down, you know, Ventura Place up here in the Valley.
Ooh, good ref.
And it's like, every single thing there is a second, third, fourth, fifth location of a thing. It's all this like kind of, you know, often VC funded versions of things to create this upper middle class white outdoor mall version of Los Angeles. And, you know, I get it. Look, like I know people who are in that position and they want to like cash out and they want to be able to send their kids to college and not be going crazy. And they don't want to just be the guy who lives above the pizzeria his whole life and, you know, dies poor.
Right.
And so I get that too. But like everything I love about LA is built out of like neighborhood restaurants right. and out of, you know, old bars and places that people have the ability to survive, you know, an economic downturn because, you know, the landlord is your partner and because you're not trying to just build everything out of growth, that it's not just this world where you have to try to scale to 20x and pour gas on the fire and see if you can get your giant cash out. Yeah. And so like, that's not what I love about Los Angeles. And that drives me nuts. And, you know, I was on some a little while ago, actually this was talking to like Adam, like my in-laws and stuff. And they're asking about the ICE raids back, you know, when they were, they're still obviously still going on, but like in their peak of being in the media so that like, you know, your in-laws hear about it and ask you.
Yeah.
And they were like, you know, what do you think? And I was thinking about it. It's like after the fires and all this stuff, if you get rid of immigrant culture in Los Angeles, I don't know that we have culture anymore. You know, the beaches are toxic from the fires spilling down into them. We don't make movies here anymore. And so when you remove all these things, if you remove like immigrant culture, like what do we have left? Just like smoking pot on the beach and playing hacky sack? Like, is that our culture? And so that kind of stuff, like these are the things I want to protect and hold up and support. And like, and that's, you know, that's something I think drives me crazy about what's happening in the restaurant business is it's, you know, when you go to investors, if you're trying to open your first restaurant or you know, your own restaurant, you've worked for other people for a long time. It's really hard to get funding if it's not like, show me the use case to grow and get us our cash out.
Yeah.
And so you have to basically go to rich people who, you know, it's like old school, like patrons. It's like, I want to support the arts. So I'm supporting a Guatemalan bakery. You know what I mean? Like that can't be the only way for this to work. And so, you know, I think that's part of it too, is like, get off the apps, go to restaurants. Like, don't just have the worst version of a food delivered to your house to get sweaty spaghetti. Oh. And guess who, like, the people who are making the money on that are not the people that it's not the restaurant. It's not the driver. Yeah. You're now just like finding a way to force these people into this new economy. And like, I'm a big believer in like, go to the places, experience the thing, walk around. Like that's how we have to do it. And so that's what drives me crazy about the restaurant business in LA right now.
Beautiful monologue on that. Let's say you're saying go to the restaurants. I don't love the question. What are your favorite restaurants? Cause putting you on the spot. But name some places, maybe legendary, historic, or maybe unknown, or maybe just throw out some restaurant names you want to support. This, I'm not holding you to top list.
No.
I know it's top of mind. Yeah, but
I've just shouted these guys out recently, but I was just talking about Ichimeyon in Torrance, this like handmade soba place that I love. Where else am I? What are some other kind of deep cuts that I love these days? I feel like I've just been going off this list that I gave for somebody else's show, trying to think of something different.
You can give me the same list.
I mean, it was like,
we'll
you
take
know,
your sloppy seconds.
Well, I think because you, you and I, we started connecting over you. I was on Luca's podcast and you saw the stuff. Yeah. And so we were talking about like salsa and beer and
LA
places
food
like
counter,
that.
By the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Shout out Luca.
Yeah. Salsa and beer and Ichimeyon and those kind of places. And so you were like,
Very happy that you have salsa and beer, by the way.
Salsa and beer is great. Good. But like, you know, you look at, I mean, even there's obviously like old classics, like, you know, like Gelaguetza, which has been around forever. And like Bricia is amazing. And Fernando, who now are like, you know, stepping up and going to the next level with that stuff. And I mean, even up here in the Valley, like, you know, Justin at Anajak is crushing and like that guy does amazing food.
Yep.
You know, and then people are really trying to do stuff like my friend, Daniel Patterson, who's like a legend of San Francisco cuisine with Qua is like now like flying in the face of, you know, what I think people are trying to do with, you know, with where everything's going. And he's like, no, I want to do my kind of food, do an LA version of fine dining. And unlike some people who you know, they come and they go, they announce their restaurant, like, you know, Rick Bayless or whatever. And he got all the crap for that. Daniel, like, lived in L.A. He helped open, like, local in Watts.
So now he's trying to do
his food in a real way out here.
What's his new product? Because I know.
Jacaranda is his new place.
You know, it's funny. I was like, you have me with the name because that's such a symbol of L.A. I was like, I don't even need to hear anymore. After that. But go
exactly.
on.
Yeah. And so that kind of stuff is really important. And so, you know, people really giving it a shot and trying to make something, don't just go to the, you know, like so often the Valley ends up getting the second version.
This is my wife's mantra. It's like every time I celebrate the Valley, she's like, just wait until we have the first of whatever instead of the second.
Like another John and Vinny's, another great white. Yeah.
You know,
and it's like, I get it. And like that stuff happens. And I'll tell you what, man, people in the Valley, they go out and they drink. Yeah. And so like, I was talking to somebody who was like a wine buyer and she was like, the same location in LA proper versus in the Valley one does 50% more wine sales. And so like,
really?
I was researching
So Valley.
And so I did a piece for Eater a little while ago where I just kind of was like, sometimes I just get to pitch stuff that I want to do as an excuse to pay a babysitter so I can get out of the house. And I was like, there's so many old bars. Oh, here's some good ones I'll hit you with.
Yeah.
Some old bars in the Valley you drive by and you've never like gone in and be like, what's the deal with that place? So here's two that people never talk about that are amazing.
Okay.
One is Pogo's.
What?
Dude, hit up Pogo's.
Where?
It's like deep, deep Valley. If somebody can Google the exact location of Pogo's. Pogo's. So it's like, if you go there at 4 o'clock on a Wednesday, there's like Caltrans workers in their vests.
That noise. Van Nuys, by the way, Sadakoy and Van Nuys. Keep going.
And they've got like cabeza tacos, like wings. They've got trash can nachos.
Yeah.
You can get omelets and whatever there. And people are out there partying. I walked in and everyone's like, you're not a regular here. What are you doing here?
Yeah.
I was writing about all these places and that place was incredible. The food was great. The vibes were great. Women just with like buckets of White Claw at 4 o'clock on a Wednesday.
Wow, Pogo's.
Pogo's was an amazing one. And then Ireland's 32.
Yes.
That place, they are like way better food than they should have to be for being like, I mean, you go to an Irish pub, they got music, they got vibes. You're like, great. But the food there is like way better than you expect it to be.
I had a 94-year-old neighbor when we lived in Sherman Oaks, and I used to call him the local Vince Scully because he was so articulate, had all these stories, detailed, like steel trap memory, and was like this incredible guy. He was the captain of a trivia team that won a national championship. Like he traveled with his trip. He was a great guy, huge drinker, and loved to eat. And Ireland's 32 was the place that he'd take us to. Dude, and it was like,
it's so good.
Dude,
the fish and chips are killer.
Good
like
spot.
Everything
man.
There is great.
Shout
that place
Mr.
crushes.
Sullivan, rest in peace.
Heck
man.
Yeah.
But
and look, I found some weird food out there too. There were some places where the food was not good, one of my Valley dive bar crawls, but you find the gems, and that's kind of the fun of it. Like, you know, I'm like still, I've got a few remaining non-alcoholic degenerate friends. Yeah. And we don't go out as much as we used to. Every once in a while, it's nice to get out there and, you know, you end up at, you know, Robin Hood, you know.
Yeah. Dude, Springbok was one I thought you were going to bring up.
Yeah, Springbok's
great. I know
great.
That was on your daily news. I mean, your world list of the 102 South African.
The Borvors and,
But that's a place that like all hours is like packed with regulars.
Yeah.
And, like,
you go watch the finals there. If there's not a rugby match that they have to have on.
Good call.
Then, that's a great one too. I mean, there's so few like sports bars that you would actually eat the food if you weren't watching a game. And, you know, we tried to do that with Bloodsoes and I think, you know, we're successful, but I can't go there because I don't want to eat. You don't want to eat your own food.
Right,
And so one of my favorites forever that's still, you know, rest in peace was Obi Bear.
What is Obi Bear?
The Korean place. It was like a basketball bar. He's nodding. Obi Bear was amazing. And it was this incredible, like, you know, like Korean bar food. You'd get like pajeon and you'd get wings.
Where was it?
I mean, in the heart of Koreatown. I forget where exactly. Okay. I can tell you how to walk there from HMS Bounty if that helps
right,
you.
Okay.
But and then that place burned down. Although most people were like, That's an insurance scam, right?
Is it when most restaurants burn down?
I mean,
isn't that kind of
and also
assumption?
Like, congratulations if you pulled it off. But also, there's like nowhere that I like as much where the food was that good and there were TVs you could watch basketball. And that's like all I want to do in the world. Like, don't make us go to B-dubs. You know what I mean? Like, let's get some American sports bar institutions.
I don't
rolling in LA.
I'm strive not to be negative because I like to uplift Los Angeles, but I have to say, and this is right in line with what you're saying, we had such a terrible sports bar experience the other day. We had no real game plan going in, so it was kind of our fault. Stanley Cup finals were on.
Yeah.
Dodger game was on. And we're like, and my buddy just got some terrible news. Like, I need to go drink. Like, you know, let's go somewhere. And we were like, what's quick? What's easy? And we went to, should I name it? Went to, I'll name it. Cause honestly, it was Game Changer.
Okay.
Right. In Studio City / Sherman Oaks. And man, it's just like every cliche in the book, in the menu, you're like Cisco, like everything was just like terrible. And like, I was like, what are we even doing?
You know,
here?
The bar at Salsa and Beer has TVs and hot bean dips.
See, it was just one of those things where it's like, we need to go. Oh, we're thinking like it's close. Like, let's just go. We ended up across the street at Boulevard Steak, which was actually a great, great fucking choice.
Well, and like, I'll see you at Pogo's for game four.
Yes. And that's what we need. But to do all this stuff, you need energy, right? And that's why, shout out to my very proud sponsor, Copico, which you said you've never heard of, which is great.
I think I've seen it around in like the, you know, in like a John's.
These used to be individually wrapped. Actually, still get them. And you probably have seen them because they were at certain restaurants. Like, I want to say Chinese restaurants would have them, even though it's Indonesian, but they're individually wrapped. But these are at like local liquor stores, some 7-Elevens. And what they are, each one of these is 40 milligrams of caffeine. Two of them equals one cup of coffee. But when I'm driving around and you need that pick me up, pop one. And I kid you not, I'm an absolute advocate of these. These work and they're delicious, by the way.
Give me a hit right now. I'll do another 2 hours of the show.
Don't eat it after the show because you got to suck on them for a while. But they're delicious and they work. So shout out Copico. All right. So let's kind of close out. You have a weekend in LA, no book tour, no events, no promotion, no filming. What are your favorite things to do in LA, man? Obviously eat, but like, where do you want to hang out? Neighborhoods, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, my answer is basically always Koreatown for everything. If I'm going out with, wife and I recently had our anniversary and, you know, ever since I'm a kid, she's not drinking as much anymore. Her body doesn't respond to it in the same way. So we did our anniversary. We just took the afternoon, dropped the kids at school, cleared the day, and we went into Koreatown. We went and got like a fun, like an Ein Spinner at like a cool, like Korean coffee shop, did the crossword puzzle, got a massage, and then went and went to Chunju Hanilkwan for lunch.
Wow.
Had like some bibimbap and some sun tofu and then we like got back and we're like, that was great. My mom's like, you guys should still go out. And she watched the kids and we went and got drunk anyway. But so it worked out. I got to do both. So like my favorite Sunday in the world now is I get up early. I grab the kids, let my wife sleep in, take them to the Hollywood Farmers Market, do all the shopping for the week, say hi to my friends there. You get all your groceries, buy your ingredients, support, you know, local farms. I always laugh because my wife is a stand-up comedian who sometimes gets paid in cash from doing some sets.
Eliza Schlesinger, right?
That's right, yeah. So one of my favorite things is that you can take basically cash straight from like German tourists who go to the Comedy Store and give it directly into the hands of farmers of Central Valley. I'm like, that's how the economy should work. And so we'll do that. Wow. And then one of my favorite little hacks with the kids is we go to Losung Tofu House because you can go. It's huge. It's like a newer place. And they've got, it's a huge restaurant. If you bring other families and kids, they'll give you a room in the back. And it's like, kids have a blast. They're just crushing rice. You're eating pajon. You're making stuff. And you get to just like, it's like there's, you can always get in. Like, I'm a big believer in counter programming. Yeah. Don't go to the Sunday brunch, like on Silver Lake Boulevard. God. Like, no one needs to get like French toast and oysters and a spaghetti carbonara. Like, go to Koreatown at like 11:30 in the morning and have the best brunch of your life.
God, well done. You brought up two things there that were interesting that I kind of wanted to get to. You mentioned Germany. I noticed when you did the Man Bites World Tour.
Yeah.
you said German, or you had to be, your German meal was from a German family who told you that there are no real German restaurants in LA.
Oh, yeah.
Which was kind of shocking because Germany is a prominent culture. Mm-hmm. You know, I know German people. Mr. Sullivan, the aforementioned my neighbor, his wife was actually German. So,
yeah.
Why yeah, is like, there no, do you, what is
it's
there?
It's like Red Lion. Like, what are the, I mean,
is that, it is, right?
I guess so. You know, they had, I mean, since that's, since then, what is it?
It was Oktoberfest all over the place, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You can drive down to Alpine Village in Torrance.
Right.
And, but there's like a, you know, there was Beer Garden LA, which was like a Korean German fusion place for a while. I think there was a place on La Brea down the street that might still be there. That's like a German place, but it's just for whatever reason, it's like, don't we all just want to eat sausages and sauerkraut and drink out of a giant stein of beer? Like, and like be able to have like, you know, like a roasted fried giant pork shank knuckle thing right. with like sauerkraut and spätzle. Like, how is that not what we want to do all day? And so good. For whatever reason, I don't know why, but we got, but yeah, we got lots of Italian restaurants.
Interesting. Okay. Number two, let's call it what it is. You're married to a celebrity. Mm-hmm. You're a public figure, but what is that like?
For you? I mean, look, I mean, it's amazing. It's not because she's a celebrity. I mean, I met my wife. We were both in our 30s.
Yeah.
And it was that thing. I always say that I skipped my first marriage and went straight to my second marriage.
Okay.
Because I didn't get married. If I'd married anybody I dated in my 20s, we'd be divorced.
Right.
And so I was so excited to go out with somebody whose life was more interesting than mine. And I got to be like, and you get to tag along and go, you know, it's like we'd both get off work at, you know, 10 o'clock on a Monday and go grab a dinner somewhere in LA last minute. And you get to do that kind of stuff. I get to travel with her on the road and see all these, there's all these amazing ancillary benefits that came along with it. None of which were the reason that I love her and the things that I fell in love with her. Yeah. But but that part of it, you know, is a fun little bonus. Like I'm somebody who would be very easy for me to get stuck in my ways, kind of be home, watch a movie, go to bed at 10:30, you know, do that every night. And so having somebody who brings more excitement into my life, brings things to do, brings like good chaos into your life is incredibly valuable. And so that part of it is incredible. And like, you know, we were dating for like 3 months. I came with her to Texas and I heard thousands of people cheering for her. And I was like, that's amazing. And so, you know, and so many of the restaurants I'm doing pop-ups were for my new cookbook Grill Time, which is out now. came about because I would tag along before we had kids on the road. And I, of course, finding all the restaurants and then food people find each other. We become friends. And now when the book's coming out, I'm texting Chris Bianco in Phoenix to see if we can do a book pop-up. Sweet. Matt McGuire in St. Louis, who's got some of the best restaurants in St. Louis, like Louis and Wright's Tavern. We did this incredible pop-up and I'm going to be in, she shot a TV show in Charleston and I became friends down there. And now I'm at Malagon with Juan Casalet. And it's just like that part of it too. It's takes you out of your bubble, out of your shell. And then we get to come home and kind of regroup and have our time with that too. And all my divorced friends also say that having your wife out of town 3 days a week is really good for a marriage.
Hey, no comment. all right. So wrapping it up, tell us, look, first and foremost, get Grill Time, buy this Amazon or any local bookstore preferred.
Now serving in LA is an amazing cookbook store. They've got signed copies. If you go in or you order online, those guys are the best, Ken and Michelle. So obviously support local. But if you want it tomorrow for less money, that's what Amazon's for. And that way, you know, it's important to make sure Jeff Bezos is doing okay.
And then Taste Made, you're filming the new episodes with Kevin.
Yeah, we got a 4th of July special coming up, an hour-long special with some amazing special guests on that one.
Is that already filmed?
That's filmed. Yeah, we shot that already. That's coming out soon. And then we're shooting another 25 coming up in the next few months. So it's so much fun. So that's coming out. And then a big one for me is, as a food professional who now has to like feed their own children, I have a Substack called I'm Legally Required to Feed You,
right,
which is all about, you know, the way that, you know, the intense pain you feel when you are a professional, people pay to make food for them and then to be rejected by a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old is soul crushing and makes you really question your self-worth and how you find value as a human being. So, This is my so weekly newsletter. You get a weekly recipe every Monday and then some other writing on Wednesdays. And it's kind of just about, yeah, how to feed your kids and the very real pain that comes along with it.
Substack. I'm legally required to feed you. Subscribe to that. Great writer, man of Los Angeles, who came out of the West Side isolation to discover the whole world. Literally here in LA, man. Brilliant. And then where do we follow you on social media?
Usually just my last name on anything. So Gluten on Instagram.
Nobody else has that name? Nobody?
Nobody took the Instagram handle. I was, my dad, my brother, they're fine. Yeah. So yeah, it's just Instagram primarily. But yeah, Instagram and Substack. Find us on, That's pretty much the big stuff. Buy the book, subscribe to the Substack.
That's the most important. And get ready to grill and get ready for some delicious food. And I didn't even say this when you brought it up, but vegetables on the grill.
Oh, yeah.
So incredible.
Oh, man.
That like changed the game for me. I remember like in my early 20s, my buddy like threw his like asparagus on the grill. And I was like, what the hell? Like, yeah. What are you doing? And then all of a sudden, like, wait, this is so like different and beautiful. And obviously that's simple and more complex what you're doing.
But a lot of it is that simple. Like I'll throw asparagus on the grill. Grill it real quick, throw it on a plate with some like aged white cheddar, some lemon juice and olive oil. Everybody is thrilled. You get food on the table quick. Like not everything has to be a crazy recipe. And so there is that stuff in the book. There's a way to do kind of more fun wood and charcoal kind of weekend project grilling. But also like this is how you get food on the table. Like I've never once in my life seared a chicken breast and put it on a salad, but I've grilled one 3,000 times.
Good job, man. Well, Noah Gluten, thank you for being here. Pick up Grill Time. Subscribe to the Substack. I'm legally required to feed you. And just keep following Noah. Go to watch The Taste Made with Kevin Bledsoe and support at Gluten. And let's keep eating good, man.
See you at Pogo's.
All right. All right, LA. It's been a minute.
Would you look at that? It's time for some of our favorite Snapple Real Facts. Real Fact 1433, toe wrestling is a competitive sport. Real Fact 732, the chicken is the closest living relative of the Tyrannosaurus Rex. And Real Fact 1599, a man once ate an entire airplane. Youch, did he have any hot sauce? Yeah, so anyways, this has been a refreshing break brought to you by Snapple. Real tea, real juice.
With Snap's Disney refreshing!
When equipment breaks down and operations come to a halt, every single second counts. So why is your maintenance team spending 60% of their time doing anything but turning wrenches? MaintainX is the AI-powered maintenance and asset management system that helps your team get back to actually fixing breakdowns. No more searching for manuals. No more hunting down parts. No more drowning in paperwork. With MaintainX, your team can access manuals from anywhere, create new procedures in minutes, and turn voice notes into clear and complete work order feedback. What used to take hours now only takes minutes. Keep your operations moving and your wrenches turning. Join over 13,000 maintenance teams that are already fixing more and filing less. Try MaintainX for free today. Go to MaintainX.com/AI. That's Maintain and the letter X.com/AI.
I'm Anna Garcia, host of True Crime News, the podcast. Every week, we bring you in-depth coverage on cases making headlines, as well as those that go under the radar. Tune in for Murders That Defy Explanation, Mystery Seeking Exploration, and Shocking Secrets That Will Leave You Breathless. Each week, we honor the victims by going beyond the salacious in our search for justice. Crime never stops, and neither do we. Listen to True Crime News, available now on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the school year ramps up, so does the time your family spends online, whether it's helping with homework, managing busy schedules, or staying connected. It's a great time to refresh your digital life, but you need a digital sidekick that works quietly in the background without slowing you down. That's where Webroot comes in. Webroot offers flexible protection for individuals and families, from standalone products to all-in-one bundles. While you handle the back-to-school rush, Webroot works to block harmful websites before you click, keeps your password password secure and easy to manage, and even optimizes your devices to keep them running smoothly. It's fast, light, and effective protection designed for your everyday life. Go to webroot.com/odyssey to get 60% off today. That's webroot.com/odyssey. Live a better digital life with Webroot, because peace of mind shouldn't be optional. Visit webroot.com/odyssey today to get 60% off. Again, that's webroot.com/odyssey.
History That Doesn't Suck is a legit, hard-hitting American history podcast told through entertaining stories. As we approach America's 250th anniversary, now might be the time to go back and learn how we got here. With more than 200 episodes, you can binge your way, decade by decade, defining event to defining event, from the founding into the 20th century. Join me, Professor Greg Jackson, for History That Doesn't Suck, an Odyssey podcast, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.